Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for coming here again at the Institute for European Studies, where we are having our fourth of six lectures on the new security challenges. Today, once again, we have Jamie Shea with us, who's going to talk about energy security and why this is a challenge for the 21st century. He will say in just a minute. Jamie, the floor is yours.
Anthony, thanks very much. Promise this is the last time I'll be here before Christmas, so you'll have a well-deserved break, above all from me. Thanks again, though, as always, for hosting this lecture. Number four, as you say, and today, as the temperatures go down in Brussels, and I'm sure all of you over the weekend have been ramping up your central heating at home and turning up the gas, we have a very appropriate topic, which is energy and energy security. And of course, as you also this week look up to Copenhagen and the last week of the climate change conference, and we all ask ourselves, will there be an agreement or will there not? We all know that energy efficiency, alternative energy sources, reducing our use of fossil fuels is going to be a very, very big ingredient in any credible deal on climate change in the 21st century. We take energy for granted. I lived for a while as a student in communist Poland, where energy was free, and it was hardly surprising that every time, even in summer, that you walked into an office or an apartment block, it was always heated well above 80 degrees centigrade. It felt that way, including with the windows permanently open. Most of us know somebody who in the 1980s or the 1990s got rich working on the stock exchange and invested in a sports utility vehicle and never worried that vehicle would only run for about 12 miles per gallon of petrol or gasoline at a time when oil was cheaper than a bottle of Evian mineral water. That was the last of anybody's worries. Indeed, geopolitics has been dominated for much of my lifetime by the big oil, as it's called. And indeed, as late as 1982, when Forbes magazine did its annual survey of the richest people in America, 15 out of the top 30 were oil barons, mainly from Texas, because still, even as late as 1982, before we came into the age of Microsoft and information technology, oil was still very much the key to the US economy and the key to individual wealth. So I'd like to start off by stressing this link between oil and geopolitics. In fact, this all started in 1912 when Winston Churchill, who was then First Lord of the Admiralty in the UK, took the decision to convert the Royal Navy from coal to oil. Because he believed this would make the new British ships, the dreadnoughts, go faster than the Germans and the American ships and give Britain a strategic advantage. And Churchill famously said, remember this because I'm going to repeat it at the end of my lecture, that safety and certainty in oil lie in variety and variety alone. Of course, once the UK ran its navy on oil, the quest for secure and abundant supplies of oil in Persia, Iraq, Middle East and elsewhere became a key strategic objective of the British Empire. Indeed, in World War One, when tanks made their appearance, aircraft made their appearance as fighting machines, and much of the army converted from horsepower, because most armies still went to war with horses. Even during the Second World War, the Germans had far more horses than tanks when they invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941. But as the conversion took place, then the dependence on oil and its role in achieving military victories grew and grew. Lord Curzon, the Viceroy of India, who later became the British Foreign Secretary after the First World War, said famously, "The Allies floated to victory upon a wave of oil." And after the First World War, as I said, the British were very grateful that they could expand their empire to Persia, to Iraq, which were at the time by far the world's largest sources of oil, apart from the United States itself, where oil was first discovered in Texas and Pennsylvania in the middle of the 19th century. In the Second World War, the battle for oil supplies was absolutely crucial. One of the reasons why Hitler decided not to strike at Moscow but to go south to the Caucasus was A, to get for the Nazis possession of the Soviet oil wells, but also to try to undermine the Russians by taking away from Stalin control of his oil reserves. One of the things that saved the British in Egypt against General Rommel, you'll all remember him, was the fact that he simply couldn't get enough oil to keep his Leopard tanks and his Panzer tanks moving towards Egypt, thereby giving General Montgomery a breathing space. Indeed, towards the end of the Second World War, what really crippled the Japanese Air Force, the Japanese Navy, and crippled the Germans from late 1944 all the way through to VE Day was simply lack of oil. By 1945, the Germans were only getting their hands on 5% of the oil that they had had in 1941 and 1942. They had lots of planes, which could have given the British Air Force and the American Air Force a very bad time, particularly after D-Day. They simply couldn't get them into the air. And a great deal of the Second World War is in fact the attempts of the Allies to bomb the German oil refineries, even as far afield as Romania, the Ploiesti field in Romania, which we never succeeded in putting out of operation, but which was fundamental for the ability of the Germans to keep up the struggle. In fact, Stalin, at the Tehran conference in 1943, famously said, "This is a war of engines and octanes. I drink to the American automobile industry and I drink to the American oil industry," because by 1944, the US was producing 90% of the high-octane fuel for all of the Allies combined. Now, this is not a history class, but nonetheless, it does bear thinking about that even since the Second World War, oil has very frequently cropped up as a key factor in international politics. Arguably, one of the most important meetings of the Second World War for President Roosevelt was not Yalta or Tehran, or for Harry Truman, even Potsdam. It was the meeting that Roosevelt had with Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the ruler of Saudi Arabia, on the Quincy in the Dardanelles in 1945, just after Yalta, when America for the first time and American oil companies gained access to the vital Saudi fields. Much of politics in the Middle East, whether you think of the coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, or the Suez Crisis against Nasser in 1956, was dictated by concerns about who would have control over the West's need for secure supplies of cheap oil. And indeed, the toll of the Arabs after the Yom Kippur War between Israel and Egypt in 1973 was to clamp an oil embargo on many Western countries and quadruple the oil price. This was, of course, the beginnings of OPEC, the cartel of Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which ended prosperity as we knew it for several years in the West. And even, of course, as late as the Gulf Wars of 1991 and in Iraq in 2003, although oil was not, and I repeat, was not the major reason for international intervention on both those occasions, whatever you believe of the motives in terms of weapons of mass destruction or whatever, but nonetheless, there were many strategists, both in the Arab world as well as in the Western world, who believed that a positive side effect of those campaigns, not the main reason, but a positive side effect, would be the fact that it would help to continue to keep the oil flowing without political manipulation. So, ladies and gentlemen, the first question for today is that if oil, big oil, king oil, as it's called in Texas, has played such an important role in the history of the 20th century, is it going to play as big a role in the geopolitics of the 21st century? Certainly, the first thing to say it is that fossil fuels are going to be with us for a long time to come. It's one of my main messages. I know that as we've been speaking about climate change in Copenhagen, we've all been thinking about alternatives, nuclear power, ethanol, biofuels, wind power, solar power. Even I heard on the radio today of a British experiment in the Orkney Islands with sea turbines, because apparently the sea moves at 10 miles an hour, which is enough to produce electricity from the deep oceans. And yes, I'll come back to this in a minute. There is every reason, ladies and gentlemen, for us to try to develop those alternative fuels, not just to save the climate, but because it's good geopolitics as well. But the reality is that today oil represents 40% of our consumption, coal 26% and gas 24%, by far the biggest proportion of the fuels that we consume. And indeed, on the best estimates, even in 20 years' time, three quarters of the energy mix will still be made up of fossil fuels. So in other words, we can maybe see a day when we will cure, as George W. Bush once said, our addiction to oil. But it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be done overnight, particularly as we consider a recent statistic from the International Energy Agency that the use of energy, even with the global financial crisis, is going to go up by 50% between now and 2030, and oil will be at the minimum 30% of that growth in consumption of energy. So what does this mean? The first strategic consequence is that the industrial countries, the Western countries, the developed countries, call them what you like, are becoming increasingly dependent upon imported energy. Many years ago, the United States sourced about 70% of its oil domestically from Alaska, California, from Texas, Pennsylvania. That figure has now gone down to 15%. In the early 70s, the US only imported about one third of its oil. Today, it's 60%. Tomorrow, by 2025, it will be up to 65%. The US constitutes 4% of the world's population, but has 250 million of the 520 million cars in the world today. And although Americans may be complaining that gas, as they call it, is much more expensive than it used to be, a US citizen only pays 18% tax on a gallon of gas compared to 70% tax in my country. So it's still cheap. UK, same situation. I just give these as examples. Some years ago, with North Sea oil and gas, the UK was looking towards self-sufficiency. But those fields are now in quick decline, so that the UK also, now for the first time for many years, finds itself as an importer of gas and oil. Imports represent today 80% of UK gas consumption. We even import 70% of our coal, although we have abundant coal fields. It's simply cheaper to get it elsewhere. And because we were used to getting the stuff from the North Sea, we haven't invested much in storage, so that we are now, paradoxically in the UK, quite vulnerable to energy cutoffs because we don't have storage capability. So the first consequence, therefore, is the big countries are importing and from a smaller and smaller group of suppliers. Second consequence is that most of the production is now coming back into the OPEC cartel, like in the 1970s. For a while, with the North Sea, with Norway and others, there was a weakening of OPEC as non-OPEC countries were supplying. But the trend in the next 20 years is that the Middle East will regain its former position as being by far the most important source of oil and gas. The Middle East has 50% of the known reserves of oil and gas. The Saudis will continue to be the decisive factor, because they alone have a so-called swing production of between 2 million and 4.5 million barrels a day, which can supply the market if, for example, there is a strike in Venezuela, as occurred in 2003, or terrorist attacks against Shell pipelines in the Nigerian Delta, or embargo against Iran, or whatever. Only the Saudis have that capability. And indeed, they've invested $100 billion over the last couple of years to be able to ramp their production up from about 10 million barrels a day at the moment to 12.5 million barrels a day if necessary. The one problem with the Middle East is its population is growing faster than any other area of the world. Today, the population in the Middle East, on average, 70% below the age of 30. So at a time when we may look to the Middle East increasingly for our imports, the Middle East is having to hold back a greater percentage of its oil and gas to feed the domestic market. According to the International Energy Agency, the Saudis alone will consume 50% more energy over the next few years, 50% more than India, even though they have one-fifth. The Middle East has one-fifth of the population of India. So first, the Middle East. Second consequence, state control. At the time of OPEC's emergence in 1973, virtually all of the oil and gas was controlled by private sector companies. Today, 15 of the 20 largest energy companies in the world are state-controlled. The Seven Sisters, as we call them, in other words, the private oil companies, Shell, BP, you're familiar with them, Texaco and so on, they today produce only 10% of the world's oil and gas, and they control less than 3% of the world's reserves. Over 80%, as I've said, is in state hands. And that, of course, has consequences. First consequence, of course, is are states as keen to sell oil and gas as private sector companies? Are they willing to invest their profits in further exploration and development? In many places, like Gazprom in Russia, or Pemex in Mexico, or PDVSA, that is the Venezuelan oil and gas company, the answer is no. For example, if you look at Venezuela, about two-thirds of all of its oil and gas profits are not reinvested. They go to pay the social programs of Chavez to obviously make sure that his electorate is happy. I'm not saying that is a bad thing, but it does mean that these countries are now facing downfalls, reductions in their ability to maintain their contractual obligations to supply oil and gas because of a lack of investment. Indeed, some well-known intellectuals such as Martin Wolf, the chief economist of the Financial Times, or the former World Bank deputy director Joe Stiglitz, or the famous Columbia economist, development economist Jeffrey Sachs, have actually spoken of something called the curse of oil. Interestingly, when oil has been in state hands since the 1960s, per capita income has actually gone down in these countries rather than up. Much of the proceeds have been spent on make work social programs. Much of the money has been spent on arms. Oil producers spend anywhere between twice and 10 times more on weapons per capita, as do the developing countries. Indeed, a Venezuelan defense minister called Juan Pablo Perez Alfonso, back in the 1960s, even called it not black gold oil, but the devil's excrement. The devil's excrement, complaining exactly of this, that instead of being like manna from heaven for a developing economy, oil can be a curse. It feeds corruption, it feeds over-militarization. A lot of the money is sent abroad rather than invested. Look at Saudi Arabia, which has had a major problem because it hasn't been able to create employment for its dramatically expanding population of young people. The oil industry produces about 95% of the revenue, but employs less than 10% of the population in Saudi Arabia. And of course, when the price goes down, and there's been incredible volatility in the oil price. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was nearly 150, you remember, dollars per barrel. Then it went down to as low as $32 a barrel at the beginning of this year. Then it went up to 80. Now it's back at around 65 $5 on the Rotterdam spot market. And that, of course, has therefore created a situation where a population heavily dependent upon subsidies has suddenly found those subsidies cut off. And many scholars have made the link between radicalisation. Remember last week we spoke about terrorism, radicalisation, and, of course, unemployment throughout the Middle East. The next consequence is that, ladies and gentlemen, the developing world is consuming more. As late as the first Gulf War in 1990-91, believe it or not, China was an oil exporter. It didn't need it. It sent it abroad. Now, as I hardly need to tell you, at a time when the Indians have introduced the Tata car for less than $1,000 and the Chinese the Chery car for a similar price, China has become a massive importer of oil. Indeed, between 2000 and 2007, 85% of the growth in energy markets has come from the developing countries rather than from the developed countries. And that tendency, particularly as China and India have not been as badly affected by the financial crisis, their economies are still growing quite healthily, that tendency will continue. Indeed, according to one statistic, if we are to keep the planet stable at about 2 degrees, well, that won't be that stable, but at least it's manageable. 2 degrees increase in global temperatures. And China is going to consume 20% more oil over the next 10 years. The only way for that to be done is for the developed countries to take a cut of 20% in their oil consumption. Now, having said that, there are still massive inequalities, let's be frank. One EU citizen consumes as much oil as seven Algerians, although those Algerians over the next 15 years will double their energy consumption. A citizen in a developing country on average consumes 8.2 times more energy than a citizen in what we used to call the third world. But as the developing world takes off, the gap is, of course, narrowing and will continue to narrow. In fact, one book that I've read recently is called The 2 billion car world. And you can imagine the consequences for consumption if we reach that particular target. Now, ladies and gentlemen, fossil fuels are, of course, non-renewable. We can only use them once. We can't recycle them. So if we are to meet the world's vastly expanding energy needs, we either need to consume less or we need to discover more reserves. But what is clear is that sooner or later, we are going to run out. This is called the peak oil debate. You've probably heard about this. There is a big controversy among energy specialists. When will we hit peak oil? Peak oil is that moment when it becomes harder and harder to discover new fields. It becomes more and more expensive to exploit those fields. Consumption, meanwhile, rises. And so inevitably, demand goes above supply. As it does, we go down very, very, very quickly in terms of our ability to supply. And of course, you have to remember that although we talk a lot about solar panels or wind or power or whatever, we still depend on oil for 90% of our transport needs. Even the US uses 70% of its oil for transport. And every time you go shopping for your Christmas goods, you go into any shop, any supermarket, 95% of all of the goods in that shop have used oil to get into that shop. So we're in a situation where clearly we have to try to see if it's possible to find more oil. Here, I'm afraid statistics are not very encouraging. Since the oil age began about 100 years ago, we've used 875 billion barrels of oil to get where we are today. The US Geological Survey estimates that there are 1.7 trillion barrels left that we know about. Doesn't mean to say they're easy to get at, you know, off the coast, very deep, under the Arctic ice pack, for instance, in shales, tar shales or whatever, in Canada, but we know about them. And the US Geological Survey estimates that there may still be about 900 billion barrels out there somewhere. That means 2.6 trillion. So you may think, oh, well, that's not bad. We've used 875 billion, but we've still got 2.6 trillion. The only trouble is that if present consumption trends continue, that's only going to get us through to about 2030, 2040. So in other words, we will use double the amount of oil in 20 years as we have used in the previous one century, getting where we are today. And this is the statistic that tells the story. Between 1960 and 1989, the world discovered, on average, twice as much oil as it consumed. But since 1989, discoveries of new fields have only been about half of the increase in consumption. The fields are getting smaller. You know, the old days where you could easily come across a $15 billion barrel field and exploit it, they are going fast. Now, I don't want to paint a totally gloomy picture here, because it's Christmas after all, and it's the season of optimism and good cheer. And indeed, you know, there are some positive signs. One is, believe it or not, the financial crisis. You may think, what? How could he possibly be saying that there's something good about the financial crisis? But we all know a mild winter last year, fairly mild, if you like, cold summer even. I was in America this summer. It was very cold, so the Americans didn't have their air conditioning systems turned on. All of this has reduced demand quite considerably. In fact, the gas price has fallen by about 80%. Causing Gazprom, which used to be the world's most powerful company, now to be seriously indebted. Gazprom has lost 85% of its profits over the last 2 years and 2/3 of its market value because of declining sales. So certainly that has helped. Although, again, let's be honest, once the economy picks up, we can rapidly see oil going back up to $150, maybe even $200 a barrel. So to the extent that capitalism always brings cycles of boom after cycles of bust, unfortunately cycles of bust also after cycles of boom, we shouldn't treat that as a permanent condition. But still, it's there. Second good news is that with technology, we're able to get a lot more out of existing reserves, to keep the fields going a lot longer because of being able to drill deeper, because geological studies are now much better at finding oil between rocks and so on. It's like when you drink out of a bottle with a straw. If you can get the straw around the edges, you can always suck up a little bit more juice that otherwise might be thrown away. For example, we can now do deep sea drilling, which we could never do before. New technology has opened up, for example, gas shells in Louisiana in the United States that have given America the prospect of being virtually self-reliant in gas in the next 20 years. So one should never sort of discount the ability of technology to come to our rescue. Also, you may have seen from in the newspapers that last week Iraq held an auction for the exploitation of 12 new fields. Iraq is probably the most underutilized source of oil we have at the moment. For example, its largest field, which Royal Dutch Shell estimates could produce 1.8 million barrels a day, is currently producing 46,000 barrels a day. And Iraq has easily the potential to leapfrog over Iran and become the country with the second largest oil reserves. The one problem, which was interesting, was that two of the fields were not auctioned for because they are in politically unstable areas, or because legal arrangements, for example, between Kurds and Sunnis, or the Kurdish authority and the Iraqi government, are not quite clear. There are also other fields. There's Yamal in the Arctic, which is Russia's biggest natural gas field. Stockman, which is Russia's largest underwater natural gas field. There's the Barzan gas field in Qatar. So there are still supplies out there. But again, I come back to what I said earlier about energy security, which is that demand is going to go up, and the International Energy Agency calculates that by 2030, to keep the demand going, we're going to have to find somewhere an extra 45 million barrels of oil per day. That's equivalent to four times the current daily Saudi production. And as I said, the tendency is that discoveries are getting smaller and the costs of exploitation are also going up. And of course, the trouble is with the financial crisis at the moment and the low oil, the low gas prices, nobody is bothering to invest in very expensive new exploitation, so that when eventually the demand goes up, because we would have not used these years to find new oil, the supply will be consistent or going down. So we're going to have a price crunch. The $200 barrel will soon be a reality. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what does all this mean in terms of NATO, European security, energy security in general? Well, obviously, for the Europeans, Russia is the major player here. It has 25% of the world's gas reserves and about 10% of the world's oil reserves, and Europe imports 40% of its gas from Russia. And as European gas consumption is due to rise by 40% in the next 20 years, most of that will obviously come from Russia. The thing about gas is you can't sort of change your customer relations, because oil, you know, comes in tankers, so you can go to Venezuela or Nigeria or somebody else. But gas comes in pipelines. You can't move pipelines, at least not very, very easily. So you tend to be tied in by the pipelines to a specific supplier, and you can't get out of that dependency unless you have massive alternative investments and an alternative secure source of supplier. Now, of course, it's also true that Russia needs to sell us gas, just like we need to buy it. Russia depends for its exports on gas. 80% of its revenue comes from raw materials. So that dictates that there should be a stable relationship. But there are some worrying signs on the horizon. First of all, as Russia becomes more prosperous, its own gas consumption is rising rapidly, up by two-thirds over the next 20 years. And if the Russians can't produce more gas, they're going to have a difficult choice. Do we give it to our own population? Do we give it to China? Do we give it to Europe? There may not be enough to go round. Russia also has underinvested in new exploitations. It's even buying gas from Central Asia at four times the price it was paying 5 years ago, particularly from Turkmenistan, to be able to put into the pipelines to make sure that it can continue to satisfy its contracts. That's not an easy situation to be in. As I say, there are new fields up in Yamal, up in Stockman, but the decision to exploit those has been postponed because Gazprom last year invested 17% less than it did the year before. It has a cash crisis. The second issue is that Russia has not attracted much Western investment and technology, mainly through a policy of state ownership. You've all seen the problems of BP TNK, which had to sell 60% of its stake in Russian petroleum to Gazprom because of sudden and massive tax bills that came out of nowhere, or the problems that Shell had in also having to sell up in the Sakhalin 2 project in the Far East. And that means that Russia may lack the Western investment and the technology to exploit the fields. And the Swedish Defence Research Agency calculates that since 91, there have been 55 disruptions of Russian supplies to Europe. And according to the Swedish Defence Research Agency, only 10 of them don't have a political motivation. And so clearly there is this worry to what degree a monopoly could be used for purposes of political pressure. So this has brought about a situation where the Europeans, in particular the European Union, have had to develop a common energy policy to make sure that they have diversified sources of supply. One is to avoid a situation where one company like Gazprom not only has a monopoly over the supply, but also has a monopoly over the distribution networks. Imagine, for example, if you have a car which is tied to Texaco, so that you can only fill up your car from a Texaco petrol station. You can't go to any other one. You can't go to a Shell one. You can't go to a Lukoil one. You can't go to Total. You can only go to Texaco. Obviously, that would greatly reduce your flexibility, as you well know. So the first thing is to make sure that producers do not also own distribution networks and thereby achieve a monopoly. The second area is pipeline diplomacy, and I know that all of you have seen this because this has been a much talked about subject. Who gets the pipelines? Across whose territory do the pipelines run? And it's clear that there are here two aspects. The first aspect is that 80% of the Russian gas goes to Europe via Ukraine. And you've seen in the last couple of winters that there have been disputes between Russia and Ukraine, particularly over payment of bills and transit fees that Russia has to pay. And on both occasions, this has led to Russia turning off the taps, and half of Europe, at least in the east, has frozen because it is 100% dependent upon Russian gas. So one aspect is for Russia to build pipelines to Europe that bypass Ukraine, for example, the Nord Stream that will go under the Baltic Sea to Germany, or another one is the South Stream, which will basically go over Turkey through the Black Sea and over into Vienna. But, of course, this would still give Russia an even greater role in supplying gas to Europe. So one other alternative is Nabucco, named after Verdi's opera, because it was first discussed while the businessmen involved in it were actually listening to Verdi's opera Nabucco, just so that any of you wondering where that exotic title came from, which is the idea of having a pipeline from Georgia through Azerbaijan, through Turkey, and then again to Vienna. The advantage, of course, there is that it bypasses Russia, and therefore Europe would have a 10% cushion, which would make sure that it had diversified supply. And it's, of course, very important for the Europeans to build precisely that pipeline. But, ladies and gentlemen, there's not much use in a car without a driver, correct? And there's not much use of a pipeline if there's no gas to put in the pipeline. And so the success of Nabucco depends very critically on the ability of the European Union to negotiate with Azerbaijan a contract which would allow at least 25% of the gas initially to come from Azerbaijan. Later on, Iraq may be able to supply it. There's even some speculation that in a long distant future, Iran might be able to supply this pipeline with gas. But it's very important not just to build a pipeline, but make sure you've identified the source of the gas. So, what can the Allies do? What can we do as a community of countries to ensure our energy security? Well, coming back to Churchill, diversification is obviously the key. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. We should build Nabucco, certainly, but we should also look at tapping in more gas from Sonatrach in Algeria or from Nigeria via a Saharan pipeline, if it can be done. And we now at least have liquefied natural gas. Qatar, for example, the United States, Australia have pioneered liquefied natural gas, which was liquefied to minus 160 degrees centigrade in tanks, in liquid, and then regasified afterwards. And of course, as it comes in ships, you can get it from any suppliers. And the EU, quite sensibly, is supporting liquefied natural gas terminals at Rotterdam and Gdansk at the moment, because you need the infrastructure obviously, to be able to bring it in. And then, of course, yes, renewables. Obviously, it's quite interesting that the UK and Denmark have invested heavily in wind and indeed get about 20% of their electricity today from wind. And, of course, up there in Scotland or Denmark, if you've been there recently, there's plenty of wind to keep those systems going. It's calculated that sun from the Sahara, if we could tap it, because again, if you've been in the Sahara recently, there's no shortage of sun, believe me. That could supply about 15% of Europe's electricity needs. And there's a great deal of focus on nuclear power. And it's true, 1 megawatt of nuclear power is the equivalent of 80,000 barrels of oil. The problem with nuclear, as I hardly need to tell you, is first of all the safety problem, the disposal of the waste, but above all, it is unbelievably expensive. The current nuclear power stations cost 5 times more than their predecessors to build and to exploit, Even the US, which has decided to go nuclear again, won't have the first new power station until 2017. And in Europe, apart from Finland, although we've been discussing a lot nuclear power, nobody has actually started yet in Europe to build a new nuclear power station. So even if we go down that route, it's not going to help us any time soon. So why don't we do quite simple things that are not going to bankrupt us? The first thing is to connect up the grid. One of the reasons why Bulgarians froze at minus 25 degrees in their apartments during Ukrainian-Russian gas dispute last winter, it is because Bulgaria did not have an interconnector from either Romania or Hungary. 60 kilometres, that's all it took to be able to pump in electricity from elsewhere. And therefore, it's good news that the European Union has now started to devote money to actually have these interconnectors. The Czechs, quite sensibly, a few years ago, had one to Germany, which meant that once they were cut off, they could get what they needed from Germany. So interconnectors. Second, storage. I mentioned that earlier. Hungary has seen the writing on the wall and has invested $850 million in storing enough gas for 1 year's supply as a cushion. And that is something, again, which the Europeans should do. The third thing that they need to do is to have what's called unbundling. In other words, a free energy market so that companies can compete with each other and gain access to pipelines, very important. Obviously, if you control the pipeline, you can determine whose gas goes into that pipeline. So a free energy market so that people in Europe can buy their gas from the cheapest supplier with real competition. And then reciprocity. The Europeans have something called the Energy Charter, which Russia hopefully will one day ratify, which means that if you own some of my production, I have the right to own some of your production. If you want to invest in my companies, then you should allow me to invest in your companies as well. The less state ownership there is, the less chance that any of energy will be the subject of political blackmail. But above all, ladies and gentlemen, do I need to tell you, the only real answer in the short term is simply like dieting. You know, you want to get slim? There's only one really good recipe. Eat less. Eat less. And it's true, if we want energy security, we're simply going to have to learn to consume less of the stuff. There is tremendous wastage. Somebody told me the other day that the old-fashioned light bulb, remember the old-fashioned light bulb? Only 4% of the energy you put in actually switches it on. The rest is wasted. And another person told me the other day something incredible, that over the next 30 years, the Chinese are going to build, in terms of buildings, the equivalent of everything that the United States has today, the real estate park. Imagine that they don't build according to green technology. You know, no insulation, no solar power, no efficient energy use. Imagine the waste that could bring about. Finally, what's in this for NATO? Probably not a lot, you may be concluding from what I've said. It clearly is a question of climate change policy, energy policy, industrial policy, and so on. But there is nonetheless an aspect, which is that of civil infrastructure protection. As the energy is traded over global distances, with liquefied natural gas tankers, oil tankers, as America gets its oil from Nigeria, not from Texas, as the India gets its coal from Mozambique, not India itself, as China goes looking for oil in the Sudan, the Indian Ocean becomes the Atlantic of the 21st century, where 90% of global trade is transported today, 65% of oil. Choke points like the Strait of Hormuz or the Strait of Malacca, through which 20% of global supplies pass every day, become very important geostrategic objectives. If you can shut those pipelines down, you can, to use Anthony Eden's phrase in Suez, you can have your hand on our windpipe. And therefore, the protection of that infrastructure becomes important. There have been terrorist attacks on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. During in the 80s, during the war between Iraq and Iran, 150 oil tankers were attacked by missiles. In the Persian Gulf. Fortunately, not many were seriously damaged, but still. In the Nigerian Delta, we have seen attacks by the local independence movement called MEND, Movement for the Emancipation of the Nigerian Delta, against Shell oil rigs and personnel and so on. And I'm not even talking about piracy, which, of course, is not about terrorism. It's about making money. But the pirates have seized, as you saw, oil tankers and have ratcheted up oil premiums, insurance premiums for oil tankers going through the Straits of Aden. So, ladies and gentlemen, I do think that there is a role for the alliance in this area of protection of critical infrastructure, and that we can use our naval expertise, our partners, to try to anticipate problems, to respond should there be a disaster or an emergency, particularly if an oil tanker gets into trouble going through the polar ice pack in the next few years to cut 2 weeks off the journey time to Tokyo, the Northwest Passage. Definitely, the military, with all of its helicopters and maritime patrol aircraft and ships, can be useful. But in conclusion, therefore, can we have energy security? Yes. But we have to do five things. Number one, we have to avoid too much geopolitics, contrary to what I said about the past, in this issue. We need to avoid a beggar my neighbour scramble for resources in the way that the colonial powers in the 19th century had a scramble for Africa, everybody trying to get their bit before the door closed. There's enough energy to go round if we share it as a common good instead of trying to monopolise it purely for ourselves and shut the other out. Secondly, well, as I said, we're wasting an enormous amount. We have to use it more conservatively, and that means probably the price will go up, because one way to make people use something conservatively is to put the price up. Thirdly, we have to protect our critical infrastructure and find ways of cooperating in doing that with Russia, with China and India, with the maritime powers of the world, who will be protecting their tankers on the oceans. Fourth, we have to bring not just the consumers into the International Energy Agency to discuss these, but also the producers like Russia, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some of the other non-Western consumers, for example, like China and India, so that there is not, if you like, on the one hand, the interests of the producers, and on the other hand, the interests of the consumers, and it becomes a confrontation or a dialogue of the deaf. But fifth and finally, we have to be realistic. You may not like King Oil, but King Oil likes you. He will be around for a long time to come. Even if today we have a crash program to invest in renewables or ethanol or solar or wind or whatever, that is going to make us, whether we like it or not, dependent on a number of rather unstable, non-democratic areas of the world. We are going to have to pay a great deal of attention, not just to how we get their oil at an acceptable price, but what we can do to help them manage the oil resource better for their own internal development and to remain stable politically. Thank you.
You just mentioned the scramble for energy and that we must avoid it. But I do think that you see India and China having a scramble for energy, especially in Africa.
Yeah.
And would you consider this a problem? And if so, what would be the solution to this?
Yeah, no, you're perfectly correct to say this. About 10 years ago, China's investments in Africa were under $2 billion. Today, they're well over $100 billion and rising fast. You're absolutely right. We have to avoid two types of situation. The first type of situation is where obtaining supplies from countries becomes so important that we overlook their human rights record, Sudan being an obvious case in point, turn a blind eye so that the international community is divided and governments like that of Sudan feel that they're under no pressure whatever to liberalise because they can sell their oil, no strings attached. So it's very important that we try to send the same message. I actually believe that China lately, because it has heard this debate, has been much more aware of the need also to send political messages to Sudan and not see itself as, you know, as a Security Council member, as a rising power, to be completely oblivious to that. So that's a positive sign. The second issue, of course, is to have a dialogue. This is why I mentioned the International Energy Agency, between the major consuming countries, so we avoid this notion of monopoly. As long as we have an open market in energy, where people are free to buy, where people are free to supply, there will be enough to go around. We are, of course, going to have to eventually get out of fossil fuels anyway because of climate change, and we will find more economical ways of developing alternatives. For example, if you take the lithium battery for electric cars, I would say another 10 years. I mean, we have the hybrid, you know, we have the Prius hybrid car already. Another 10 years, the electric car will be a reality. So there's no long-term reason why, as I say, half the world should be supplied and the other half would not be supplied. But the key thing, you're absolutely right, is to have a dialogue. And the other thing, of course, is to make sure that the money which is invested really does benefit the people of Africa. Not goes into the, you know, Swiss bank accounts of people in the regime. So much of this oil money has been wasted, which is the reason I mentioned the curse of oil. It's gone into prestige projects, you know, that didn't benefit the people. It hasn't created employment. It's been used to favour one tribe or one faction over another. And we have to at least have some kind of dialogue to ensure that, you know, the investments that do go in are not just sort of compensation for oil, but serve the long-term development needs of the country concerned. So that would be my view. But of course, it's also very important that if we ask that of the Chinese or the Indians, that we play by the same rules ourselves, obviously, in terms of not being against their desire to invest in Western fields of companies. There was a case a couple of years ago, you may remember, when a Chinese oil company, CONOC, the Chinese National Oil Corporation, tried to buy an oil company in California, and the US Congress introduced a resolution in the name of, you know, national security to stop that from happening. And I think it's very important, as I said, if we're going to encourage the Chinese, the Indians and others, that there really be an open market, that we allow them to invest in our companies and so on, subject to the usual rules of transparency and exactly, but that in return they allow us to invest in their companies as well. So we take energy to the extent we can out of state control, where unfortunately it's been going in the last few years, and put it more and more into the hands of the markets, who, you know, the profit motive will be enough for them to invent the technologies and find the capital to develop new fields.
What's your opinion about fusion for energy ITER project in South of France?
I'm not a specialist on this. I mean, my brother-in-law is a nuclear physicist. I should have invited him here today. And there is this new technology called cold fusion, which does seem to offer great benefits if it can be developed. But all I'm saying, though, is that when we come to nuclear, we have to sort of distinguish, if you like, between some of the hype, you know, the expectations, and the actual reality, which is that it's very, very difficult to develop the third generation nuclear power stations. A French company has been, because France, as you know, is a big developer of nuclear power, and France sells many nuclear power projects abroad, and it's been developing one in Finland for the last few years, which has suffered very extensive delays, precisely because, you know, getting the technology right is very, very difficult indeed. And if you can show me a nuclear power station which is not at least 10 years behind schedule on construction, I would generally be surprised. So I'm not saying no to nuclear, because in many respects, it's, if you want a carbon-free source of energy, it is one that holds tremendous promise. But we just have to be realistic. You know, governments of private companies will not build a nuclear power plant unless they're given massive, massive subsidies from governments to do so. Where they don't have those subsidies, the private sector doesn't really touch it. It's quite interesting that over the last few years, the private sector has invested four times more in wind power than it has in nuclear power, where the subsidies have not been forthcoming. So I think the nuclear power may be something for the longer term, once we get the technology right, once we deal with the wastage, once we find ways of managing the costs, and also protection against terrorist attack. But above all, and I mentioned this in my very first lecture when I spoke about proliferation, provided we come up with a new nuclear proliferation treaty that gives us some guarantees that all of these new nuclear reactors around the world, which people are foreseeing, aren't simply going to allow more regimes like Iran or North Korea to process their own fuel, enrich their own uranium or plutonium, and build their own bombs. Because that's the problem, you know, that we are, how do you ensure that the peaceful nuclear power won't be diverted for military purposes? So I think sorting out these issues is going to take time. That's why I think that nuclear has promise for the future, but don't see it as a panacea for the next 10 to 20 years.
I would like to stress your conclusion number two, that we have to use energy more efficiently or use less. The existing installed capacity of fossil power generation has a efficiency rate of 30-32% worldwide, whereas a state-of-the-art technology existing is up to 60%. So by using the latest technology, we could even almost double the outcome of electricity we get out of every gallon of oil or every cubic meter of gas. And there's such a huge potential. I mean, the EU spends 700 billion euros per year on fossil imports. That's much more than the US recovery plan, but every year. So the money that can be saved is so much. The pollution that can be saved is so much. The security that can be limited just by using it more efficiently, also in the power generation.
Yes. Your question, you obviously are a student of these matters, sir, from judging by your question. The best answer I can give you is that, yes, there is a lot we can do. For example, just in making the building industry conform to certain standards when it comes to insulation, solar panels, night storage of electricity, which can then be recycled the next day rather than wasted. Again, I don't pretend to be a technical person at all, but I'm sure that in terms of regulations on the building industry, there is an enormous amount that could be done. I mentioned the Chinese example. Jimmy Carter, incidentally, was also ridiculed a few years ago when he suggested, you know, during the gas crisis in America after the Yom Kippur War, that Americans should turn down the heating and put on a sweater. And he was ridiculed for that. But it's not necessarily bad advice, quite frankly, in terms of one's own consideration. Building public transport networks where you can travel on high-speed train, which uses about one-fifth of the energy of an aircraft to get to your destination, is a case in point. Just like, you know, obviously public transport rather than the individual use of cars. I mean, these are not new ideas. They go back and back. Even the EU directive now on using the new type of light bulbs, which have a much greater lifespan and much less use of energy than the old ones. I mean, these are fairly simple things. The one point I would make, though, if I just put this glass down, is that we've got to make sure that we look at the totality. One of the things that I think did go wrong was the original EU policy on ethanol, biofuel and ethanol. You remember? There was suddenly, like we had the dash to gas a few years ago, we had the rush into ethanol as the kind of panacea that was going to, you know, be the alternative to petrol in cars. But when we looked at it, what we discovered is that, first, the old types based on corn ethanol rather than grasses, actually put more CO2 into the atmosphere than fossil fuels. Number two, farmers looking for subsidies, and this was certainly the case in the United States, suddenly started to convert their land to produce corn, which was no longer available for food. Food prices went up, and you actually had food riots. I mean, this is not exclusively the EU. The United States and other places are doing it as well. In the Amazon, they were thinking, hey, the corn price is going up. Let's chop down the Amazon. And as I said in an earlier lecture, about 20% of all carbon storage is done in the Amazon in the world. So it was stupid, to be putting more CO2 from ethanol while cutting down forests that capture CO2 to produce more ethanol. And we all know that the price of a tank of ethanol for a BMW 5 Series would feed a hungry African for 1 year. 1 year. Even if the United States, this is a lovely statistic that I've found, converted all of its agricultural land to ethanol production, it would only be 1/5 of what the Americans consume in gasoline every year. And eventually the EU recognised that corn-based ethanol was not really a solution and it changed its policy. I'm not saying that other types of ethanol based on cellulosic technologies can't be effective, but it's an example where, you know, you suddenly think you've got the panacea, you rush into it, but without understanding that it has, you know, in economics, in terms of food production, in terms of climate, it other consequences as well. So it's important to sort of, you know, get the package right, that's why, again, I think that, you know, a diversification based on a range of different alternatives rather than one is probably going to be the best way forward. Yes, sir.
I have 2 points to make. You just mentioned China now is a massive importer of oil. It's true, but maybe just halfly. Coal, the consumption of coal, still China relies mainly on coal consumption. It's true, China, the import of oil is on rise. I'm not an energy expert, but I have no statistics on hand. As far as I know, the coal consumption still about 90% of China's energy consumption today. That's 1 point. The second is that you mentioned it about China's investment on African some African countries' oil industry. It's true, but compared with Western countries, China's investment in Africa is still quite low. The other is China's investment on African energy industry stem on basis of equality, mutual respect, and mutual benefit, as well as for the good of the global community. Because, as I said, I'm not an expert on this area, but the majority of oil products of China's company in Africa were sold in global market. So it plays a positive role to make the global market stable, right?
Thank you, Norman, for those, again, very, very good questions. On China, China imports about 50% of its oil at the moment. But given, you know, obviously its population, its very rapid rate of development, that figure will go higher. I think you're right. Coal is the crucial issue because China has a lot of coal. Coal is still, I think, in the world today, the major source of electricity, including in the United States, by the way, which has the world's largest reserves of coal. And my country, I mentioned, too, the United Kingdom, we still depend upon coal. And, of course, everybody remembers from Eastern Germany, you remember the days of the Cold War, you know, the pollution caused in Eastern Europe by the burning of lignite and brown coal for the environment. So coal is the biggest polluter of all. Coal top, oil in the middle, and natural gas much lower in terms of fossil fuels. And I think that one of the key challenges for Copenhagen, and we spoke about this earlier when I spoke about climate change, is to come up with some kind of technologies that can be used to sequester carbon caused by the burning of coal, to capture it and then to bury it so it doesn't enter the atmosphere. And, of course, this goes to the debate about how much money, $10 billion a year, year, 20 billion a year, the developed countries are going to give to the developing countries in order to procure this technology for carbon capture and storage. But this is, I think, is going to be the key, because I see statistics, you must know the situation better than I do, but I see statistics that China is planning to build 550 new coal-fired power stations over the next 20 years, and that potentially is a lot of CO2. That said, I don't know if any of you were listening to the BBC World Service radio over the weekend. Probably you were doing Christmas shopping and had better things to do. But there was an interesting series of programmes by Jonathan Porritt, who used to be the director of Greenpeace, called Can China Go Green? And he actually presented quite an optimistic picture that the Chinese are very aware now of climate change as an issue. They have, in Copenhagen, they've accepted targets, as you know. China is now the world's largest investor in solar panels. It has some of the most advanced companies producing solar panels and so on. And China is crucially aware, particularly in the building industry and so on, of the need to cut CO2. So he presented it as an interesting challenge between, on the one hand, you know, the rapid speed of China's economic development, which is pushing forward, you know, the large increased consumption of coal, of fuel, gas. But on the other hand, also a sort of sense that, you know, we've got to do business differently. We've got to use new technologies. We've got to cut CO2. And forgive me, he said it was the yang and the yin, as it were, the two conflicting tendencies. And which one in the 21st century will win? And the future of not just China, but I think the future of climate change is largely going to depend on how China manages that. When it comes to Africa, you know, you're quite right. I spoke about the curse of oil. We've seen so many countries, I don't need to name them, but that have not used the fantastic revenues from oil to modernise and to transform in the way that you would have expected. You know, Saudi Arabia, for example, its per capita GDP was ahead of the United States in the 1950s. Which is incredible. That's not the case today. Many Middle Eastern countries in the 1950s had a per capita GDP 4 or 5 times that of South Korea. Now it's the opposite. South Korea is 4 or 5 times higher. So what we've seen is, frankly, is that those countries that don't have natural resources have developed their service industries, developed the skills of their people, developed job opportunities in a way that those countries which have been able to rely upon oil to fund a very bloated state sector have not done. And as I say, as the price has become more volatile, they've had boom and bust and social instability. So now we have a number of new countries coming onto the market. We have Sudan, we have, for example, Ghana, which has recently discovered very large oil deposits. Brazil, which has now, as I've said, discovered large deposits off its coastline. Can they be more like Norway, if I could put it that way? Norway, which has used its oil and its gas and put a vast amount in a fund for future generations and used it very in a very targeted way for its own development. Can we try? And I think it's not just a challenge for China, it's a challenge for the World Bank, for the United Nations, for all of us. What we can, to persuade countries, as I say, to use it in a way that's really going to kickstart their long-term development and not produce a situation where vast amounts are wasted on military forces, on prestige projects, on corruption, and the general population doesn't really see much of an increase in the standard of living. And of course, you know, as the Shell experience in the Niger Delta convincingly shows also, you know, the oil companies too have much more now a duty of social responsibility vis-a-vis the populations where they develop the oil in terms of environmental damage, in terms of, you know, development of the local population and so on. Because when it doesn't happen, as Shell discovered in the Nigerian Delta, they then have an insurrection which kidnaps their executives, which cuts their pipelines or attacks their rigs and makes life very difficult. So that's the challenge as I see it. I'd like to thank all of you today very much. The good news is that you get a break, both from me and from university or from whatever over Christmas. But for those of you who still have the stamina to complete the course, we have two final lectures in the new year, one on cyber crime, and the final one on fouled states. Are they still going to be as big a problem in the 21st century as they were in the last decade of the 20th century? So hopefully I'll see at least some of you after Christmas. In the meantime, happy Christmas, very happy new year. Thank you again for coming today.